Hello, this is Elizabeth Anderson. Welcome to the 10th Voice, and I will remind you all that these are not the opinions of Midcoast Radio, KKFI, or other volunteers, but we are the voice of the LGBT community. And I want to welcome first the author of the book that we're going to discuss on the Santa Morian Radio Book Club. Bonnie, are you there?
Yes, hello, and hello listeners.
Hi, Bonnie. And we also have Michelle Pond.
Hello, Elizabeth.
And Philip Hooser.
Why, hello.
I do have a question for each of our panelists, and I'm going to start with Michelle. Michelle, tell me some of your reactions as you read this book, The Disappearing L.
First, I think the complexity of what we're dealing with, how, you know, things don't happen in a vacuum, so there are so many other influences. That probably was one of the major ones I had. Another thing I thought of, and actually more last night when I was kind of going over some things, is that we as human beings we discard people pretty easily, and I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Let's come back to that idea. That's an interesting one. Philip, what about you? What were some emotions or thoughts, just overarching, as you read?
That I'd read it before, except for gay male culture in 1996.
Reactions I had, because I came out relatively late at 41.
Wow.
Hi, Bonnie. I missed so much, because I came out in 93, 94, and the older lesbians were so far ahead of me that as I read this, there was a sense of loss for what I didn't know, and joy for what I have had, particularly in working on festivals. And now I'm going to throw the question to you, Bonnie, because as you did the research for this book, what were some of the emotions as you discovered?
Sure. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be very upfront about what I did with this particular publication. This is my 13th book. I've been teaching women's history for 30 years, and I came out as a teenager. I was 19 in 1980, and the minute that I came out, I walked right into a lesbian culture that had been laid down for me by feminist foremothers. I was able to go to women's music concerts every night of the week. I could go to festivals. I could go to women's bookstores. Not only was there a subculture, which was an alternative to the bars, and that's important because sometimes gay bars had been all that existed for people isolated in smaller towns for many decades. There were also, quote, lesbian celebrities at festivals and book signings who were very easy to meet. In short, I was able to participate in the culture, and I was able to meet and, in most cases, make friends with the very role models who had put themselves on the line as authors or musicians or composers. And I started taking notes at a really early age in my journal, and then I began tape recording entire festivals verbatim because I felt that what was going on was a very important movement that was not being reflected in the mainstream. And to a large degree, festivals and concerts were very discreetly held. They weren't promoted heavily in local press because of homophobia. Women could be really punished in ways we have so forgotten so recently. You could lose your job, custody. So we don't have a very big paper trail for how lesbian culture was advertised to other lesbians. Before the internet, a lot of it was word of mouth and flyers and direct mail, and those copies of Lesbian Connection that were stapled shut. So going to events, I was also documenting events, and then I began to write about the culture. By the late 90s, I had been writing for Hotwire magazine, and I kind of wanted to collect a lot of my pieces into a longer book, and I had enough material to do the first book on women's music festivals as a subculture, and my goal with that was to talk about what is the audience responding to? What need does this fill? How do women feel when they realize there are thousands of them in a night stage bowl, and they each feel individually that the artist on stage is speaking directly to them. And now, just 15 years really after my first book on festival culture was published, all but three festivals are gone. The entire culture has changed. Not only have many of those formative events stopped being held or disappeared, there's actually a backlash against them. So even if you want to keep it alive through memory or missing the Michigan Festival, there's a sense that that's forbidden, that to identify an association with the place where you came out, the place that radicalized you, that's being shamed. Because there are many people who are hostile to Michigan as a woman-only space event. So we're kind of facing this trifecta of the community is aging and a lot of the original founders have stories to tell, but we're really reluctant to collect them and share them because of conflict in the community over how we should valorize recent radical lesbian history. And someone like me, who's a historian, you ask what emotions I feel, of course I go right to intellectualizing because I hate feeling pain. It's painful for me to see elders being silenced and forced back into a kind of closet. It's painful for me to see institutions I love disappear. As an author, I certainly miss the bookstores where my stuff would be sold. And I also feel very protective of the sensibility of women who have a right to remember the events that made them feel they could come out.
Well, if you don't mind, let's talk for just a minute about, you mentioned three festivals are left, mm-hmm. and one is the National Women's Music Festival.
Yes, which is so great, still going strong.
I've been on crew there as a house manager for a stage for 7 years, and I found it interesting that in your book you say that it has never received the critical attention it deserves for hosting outstanding performances across the mm-hmm. decades, and I believe it's yours. 43. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people, because I'll mention the National Women's Music Festival, and they say, no, it ended. I'm like, no, it didn't. It's going strong. Why do mm-hmm. you think that is? And then I'm going to throw a question to Philip and Michelle.
That's an excellent question. As a historian, I have to be fair and accurate and say there were a couple of 1 or 2 day events on the West Coast before the first festival we associate with national began. There was a one-day event at San Diego State. There was a Kate Millett had a festival at Sacramento State. There was a Midwest Lesbian Festival in the Ozarks. But the first organized women's music festival, national, which was first held in Illinois in 1974, is still going strong, and a lot of people are unfamiliar with it. It has always been held on college campuses until in the past decade there was a switch to using a hotel site. So part of the distinction is, unlike some of the other private festivals, it often had men around. You couldn't take your shirt off like you could at the other places. So there was kind of a contrast to some of the wilder, more naked events, if you will. But on the other hand, the advantage that National had, which enabled it to do such extensive programming, it was able to have like a film festival, a writer's series. There were all these indoor venues. It used the beautiful concert hall at Indiana University in Bloomington. So people could come in who did artwork or presentations that would have been sort of at risk in a rainy, windswept outdoor festival. And I honestly have to say, if we look at the history of how festival culture emerged from the Midwest, you know, you have National, you have Michigan. In much of gay history, we get too much emphasis that everything either began in New York or San Francisco. And let's be fair to the beautiful middle part of the country from which you are speaking right now, and the fact that the Midwest is much more hip and cool than anybody understands. And I'm important to give a shout out to all my Chicago people. The Midwest is where the All-American Girls Baseball League began. It's where so much war work brought women into more empowered roles in World War II. So it's not that surprising that these, you know, longest, oldest festivals began there. But I think that National was simply overshadowed in what people want to see as the radical element of Michigan, outdoor, clothing optional, what have you. On the other hand, the same artists played at both places. So it's not possible to talk about lesbian performance culture without pointing out, here are the artists who played at festivals, plural, and they went from one place to another, and the festivals were on a calendar that stretched from Easter to October, and they were on different weekends so that artists could play at all of them and try and earn a living part of the year. And women in the 70s, 80s, and 90s had a calendar that enabled them, if they had the money or if they were able to take time and be volunteers and do work shifts, work exchange, they could go to National in June and the Northampton Festival in July and Michigan in August and the New England Festival over Labor Day weekend and on and on. And you planned your year based on immersion in events that would sustain you for whatever tense or homophobic work and family trauma you might have in the winter. You stored up the pride and joy at these getaways that were your spring and summer. I think there's a lot of people who are connecting now in cyberspace, but that's very different than sitting around a campfire or laughing together in a giant, beautiful concert hall.
I want to mention here that our producer and sound engineer is Linda Wilson. She would
a goddess.
I would tend to agree with that. A very quiet, fairly self-effacing goddess.
Mm-hmm.
She would have been on the air with you today. She read the books, but she is on a boat in the Everglades. And
Well,
we agreed that probably connections would be at best problematic. But Linda is, as you know, the producer and president of the board of the National Women's Music Festival, and she gives credit to the board. She has done so much here in Kansas City mm-hmm. and the region and nationally. And I'll mm-hmm. tell people, did you know Linda did this? And they have no idea. And that's why I want to throw a question to Michelle and to Philip. Michelle, were you aware of all of the musical names, the performers, the artists, the writers that are mentioned in this book?
Absolutely not.
And yet you've been a reader for years.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and probably, and quite frankly, I really didn't know much of the music scene until I met you. So that's really just been in the last couple of years.
And Philip, what about you? All of these names.
But there were some new names to me as well.
And one of the things that surprised me in reading the book, in a good way, and Philip, I'll ask you first about this, is I didn't know just how many of these performers and authors and speakers were Jewish. That chapter just was a wonderful surprise, Philip.
Oy, gewalt, Elizabeth. Well, yes, because don't you know that Jews control the media? I mean, they've been telling us that for years. The word is out there. No, I wasn't surprised by it, though. I think that certainly a lot of artists, you know, suffer, and that's what makes them artists. And I think that if there's any group of people, it would be the Jews, or according to a Mormon belief, my people, Native Americans, are also a lost tribe of Israel. So
mm-hmm.
I think we're all mishpucha.
I wanted to put that chapter, and of course, what they're referring to here is the book is structured in terms of acquainting the reader with large institutions in lesbian culture that had so many participants until semi-recently. So there's one chapter on the soundtrack of Our Awakening, which talks about the rise of women's music concerts. And then I point out, then we get women's music festivals, and then we get women's bookstores and those kinds of knowledge spaces and sites and gatherings. But chapter 4 is about the rise of Jewish lesbian identity and membership groups or spirituality groups or prayer groups or whatever, because I thought it was important to talk about how vital that was. And my job at three different festivals was to run a Jewish networking for women, not all of whom were gay, by the way. Not everybody who goes to festivals is gay, but the place for talking about a Jewish identity within feminism, that was really a big deal, which attracted a lot of women to go to these events, and that was something I wanted to talk about because I felt that there were overlaps in terms of how within the same decade that lesbians and feminists found new identity in talking about a shared Jewish background, it became a very shameful thing to identify as a Jewish feminist because people will say, well, how do you feel about the Israeli government? Don't you agree its policies are oppressive? And you had about 10 minutes to feel pride as a Jew. And my point is, it's very similar to the shaming that's going on around the Michigan Festival. You had, you know, a festival that you could identify with as a place for your people, the lesbians, and now there's a lot of backlash about, but what about the trans women? So in both places, there was gathering around a shared identity, and now a sense that not only is it exclusionary to have that pride, but you should disassociate yourself from the space altogether. Anyway, I also wanted to make it clear that, yeah, a whole hell of a lot of the movers and shakers who founded lesbian cultural spaces were, in fact, Jews. And for a tiny percentage of the United States, less than 1%, there were so many women who committed themselves to production. Everybody from, you know, Robin Tyler and the people who started festivals in the Southwest, and women who did sound and light production. And it's a great tribute to a commitment to justice in a particular community. But I'm happy that that chapter's in there, and that's been very moving for a lot of people.
I am, too, because I think it especially pointed out ideas about intersectionality.
Yeah.
And how we don't always deal so well with that of thinking, oh, wait, you're this, but you're also this. Which one of those is more important? Well, they're both important. It really reminded me of the old quote about, if it weren't for Jews and homosexuals, there would be no Broadway.
Well, or sign language interpretation, because that's also, I think, something I hope is clear. You're quite right. There's so many identities. I mean, certainly I talk about the unlearning racism component of all of these spaces and events, and now there's a couple of really good books out on just women's bookstores alone as spaces for unlearning racism. But you also had festivals and concerts and bookstores as sites for unlearning ableism and making things accessible and making sure music was sign language interpreted, which had not really been a trend before. And the funny thing for me was I ran a Jewish women's networking tent, and we shared it with the interpreter community, and it turned out they were practically all Jews, so we were all in there together, and everyone talked with their hands, ha-ha. So there's a lot about the intersection with the disability rights community and the location of all of those activists in lesbian culture, in terms of often women being the caregivers in a family or the people who were looking for communication breakthroughs, but also little facts that I hope that I've helped promote. You know, Michigan had one of the best and largest disability access campgrounds in North America, and a huge deaf camping community, and all kinds of efforts to bring to the stage, and we saw this at National, too, groups like Axis Dance Theater, which was a disabled dance troupe. Things that people as audience consumers don't expect to see and then have their minds changed. And certainly at National, some of those radical artistic presentations, because it was an indoor and well-protected venue, you would have the opportunity to see what it might mean to have choreography based around a wheelchair or, you know, beautiful and hilarious sign language interpretation where the comedians start to get kind of miffed because the interpreters are getting more applause than they are.
Well,
and then the audience is grooving on that, and you have all of that bringing people across boundaries.
I have seen that at National. I've seen some of the singers sing as fast as they possibly can, and the interpreter is just keeping up, and the audience is riveted on the interpreter.
That certainly brought me into relationships with a couple of interpreters, I don't mind saying on the air, because that kind of talent is just appealing.
It is. I want to take the conversation back for a minute to the Jewish. One of the things that that I really enjoyed reading and appreciated in your book was when you described the crew, the backstage mm-hmm. people, who you and some others had an exercise. And
oh, yeah, uh-huh.
And you, as a Jewish lesbian, were saying, stand up if you've ever. And you mm-hmm. were standing and sitting throughout, whilst mm-hmm. many in the crew were sitting. Thought mm-hmm. that you described that beautifully.
Well, thank you, and I give credit to the people who originated that exercise. I can't remember the name. That was certainly brought to the Michigan crew by a longtime justice activist, Penny Rosenwasser, who has a wonderful book out, Hope Into Practice. And work that we did that evening, it had been customary for years and years for the worker crew, which could be hundreds of women, by the way, to do an anti-oppression workshop the Thursday evening before the festival began, and everyone is always exhausted and tired, and that's the day the short crew arrive and set up, and everybody's a baked potato, and then you go right into this emotionally wrenching, very difficult group activity, which usually focused on confronting racism on the land and in our lives, or ableism, or ageism, or misogyny, or internalized, whatever. And we did one on anti-Semitism that was particularly new in some ways, because it had people standing and sitting in response to questions like, you know, I have been told I don't look Jewish. I have been asked to account for Jews in the media. I have been told to my face that, you know, Jews have all the money. I have been made to feel that all Jews are communists. I mean, it went through all of the different stereotypes. And what was astounding about that was, of course, many of the women who were targets of that kind of talk, we all, for the most part, looked white and were very clear about owning our, you know, white privilege. But at the same time, there was all this other stuff that we lived with all the time that in a lot of ways was a questioning of our Americanness. And a large percentage of us were the first generation American or children of, my mother's a first generation American. So that whole aspect had people like weeping and afterwards saying, wow, I heard stuff tonight that, you know, my own girlfriend never told me about. And it helped us to then be able to interact with women who had a whole lot of questions they had just never felt encouraged to ask. And after that, I noticed the festival really increased, usually having an artist or a performer one evening who did some kind of traditional Jewish music, whether it was klezmer or more Sephardic, or we would all get up and dance. And it allowed a visual to show what a high percentage of Jewish women were in festival culture and kind of getting things done. So that was just, that's just such an important chapter. I really appreciate your letting me talk about it, too.
Thank you. And Michelle, you had a reaction to this part of the book.
The part that I reacted to was the idea of being an Orthodox Jew mm-hmm. and having to reconcile being a feminist
mm-hmm.
and the problems that created in the religious community.
Mm-hmm. And I was told about 7 years ago that I would need to go on headphones on the main stage Friday at sundown. The woman who was on headphones needed to be off them because that was considered work and would go back on Saturday.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so every year I go on mm-hmm. headphones, and that is a very conscious reminder to me.
It's a wonderful role.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, the person who was a righteous Gentile, you know, who does that, one of the things that I talk about in that chapter is it could be any person's religious practice that is changed when you are doing it in primarily lesbian space, or you are doing it out in the woods without the walls, frankly, or any of the normative comforts and facilities. And just in the example of running a Friday night Jewish women's service for, you know, 20 years, what I saw, which we could apply to any faith, was how freaked out women were about saying God, she, okay? And that of all the radical things that were going on, I mean, here were women who were, like, naked, they were letting their beards grow, they were challenging traditional femininity in every direction, but they had a hard time having the language of a prayer service changed to think of God as gender neutral or God as he and she. That really revealed to me how far we have to go. Women who were willing to, you know, like march on Washington and demand change or the right to get married or whatever didn't want the traditional Hebrew pronouns changed, you know, and I joke in that chapter, that's not the way I learned to pray as a child, wailed one Amazon who was wearing nothing but a drum and a loincloth. Exactly. So if feminizing spirituality is still so scary, no wonder we have tension about the feminine in human form.
I will admit that I had no guide to lesbianism when I came out at age 41 in 1993. No guide. And I found the whole lesbian radical feminist scene pretty scary. And mm-hmm. I hadn't seen women with beards. I didn't know the music. I didn't know the culture. I didn't know how to dress. I didn't know how to speak. And some of the lesbians, I realize now in reading your book, were equally thrown by me.
Mm-hmm.
I had always put it on them. They were mean. Mm-hmm. They snubbed me. But I realized as I read how much was involved in lesbian culture, they didn't know how to read me. They didn't understand mm-hmm. me. I was confused. So I want to, if you don't mind, I'm going to take a break. Please don't go away, Bonnie.
No.
We're going to play a song and then I'm going to ask you about it.
Okay.
Here come the lesbians. Okay, Bonnie, what was the name of that song and why is it important?
That is Leaping Lesbians. That's by Sue Fink and Joellen Grippo. It was also recorded and popularized by Meg Christian. It is something I think that you can enjoy on the Lesbian Concentrate album from Olivia.
Yes.
It is simply a wonderful parody of the idea that lesbians are scary and that better watch out because here comes this alien creature. And at times, the women's community, as you just said before the break, if you come into it as an adult, you can feel like there's a whole bunch of rules and that it can seem cliquish or everybody seems to know some kind of secret insider information you don't. And if the first 2 people or 10 people that you meet are kind of rude about, you know, you mean you've never heard of her? I think you would find that in a lot of subcultures where people who have been marginalized elsewhere or marginalized and oppressed in the mainstream, when they find their own kind, they set up lots of rules and taboos, and then you're kind of hazed or initiated when you come in, and then you find your comfort zone, and then you get to haze the next people who come in. It's the same in academia, but the song makes it clear that there are a whole lot of Americans and people in other countries who, until recently, could live their whole lives feeling like they never knew anyone gay, and were, if asked, likely to give you a real caricature of what that woman might look like. And then they're shocked to find out it's Cousin Anne or whoever. So we've now moved to a point where we have folks who seem very normal as gay heroes and heroines on TV, and fewer people are able to perpetuate the notion that a lesbian is someone who is scary. But something I tried to write about was how in the community all of us had to learn how varied we were and to see the reaction of a young woman meeting an 80-year-old lesbian elder for the first time or meeting women from all over the world and realizing, yes, there are gay people in every country, every language, learning about traditions in Native American culture, learning about the deaf community. That has moved the women's community into acknowledging
what?
The range.
Bonnie,
yeah.
If you don't mind, I'm going to broaden the conversation just a little bit here.
Okay.
I like what you said about subcultures, and I want to throw it to Philip, because as a gay man and a Native American, what Bonnie just said about you know, the unfamiliarity, the idea that the culture is scary, but it's also cliquish. Could you speak to that?
Well, to a certain degree with Native Americana, the culture isn't as scary to people anymore because we have been disappeared. We have been relegated to our own spaces and are actually being killed off at a higher rate as percentage of the population than other, you know, ethnic groups. But we don't get as much attention. We don't have good lobbying and marketing efforts on behalf of the red. My mother is white, my father is red, so I think of myself as pink in every possible way.
And you do get caricatured, though.
Oh, yeah. And I'm actually kind of fine with a little bit of caricaturization because I play on it as well. Like saying, I'm pink in every possible way. It's my way of taking back any kind of power for that.
But, you know, I find that what you've just talked about, my experience, let's say, is as somebody who is active in teaching about Native American culture and, in particular, female athletes in the Native American community and their history. If I go to a giant women's festival and I see, you know, a lesbian who's hip in every way, but she's wearing, like, a Washington Redskins T-shirt, that's where I go, oh, my God, there's so much work to do. Because one of the things that I think was a challenge for all of us is discovering that you find one group you identify with only to discover that within it there are biases against other groups. And the first time that I found in my own family Jews who made racist jokes, or found in the gay community gays who made anti-Semitic remarks, or found in another community. And if we stop and scold each other all the time, that is not the equivalent of a party. So there are lots of people who backed away from lesbian politics because they felt it was so politically correct and so intent on educating, and that what should have been a women's music concert turned into a lecture by various performers who incorporated, you know, a lot of info. That's certainly an aspect of the subculture, the need to educate. And there was a call from the stages in the 80s and 90s to interrupt racism where you saw it. So women really did. They yelled out, hey, stop that. That's racist. And they tried to shut down performers who might make remarks they weren't aware of. And finding a balance between listening and then talking to the person versus threatening them from the audience, it's been a learning curve.
Thank you, Bonnie. I want to jump off from that point because you're absolutely right. It's not the equivalent of a party. I'm going to use that line. I like that line a lot. But I've recently seen a lot of name calling on social media and in blogs, and my blood pressure goes up, and it makes me angry. Because you have, on the one hand, feminists being called TERFs, trans exclusionary radical feminists, and that is a slur that just gets thrown around. But at the same time, I see my trans friends called lady men, which that's hurtful. That is very wounding. It's painful. Mm-hmm. I have friends who have been, just as I struggled for decades to think about coming out. Once I didn't even know about gay culture until about, I guess I was about 22, didn't know anyone, never heard about it. It was hurtful to me when I came out to be told, no, you're not. You can't.
Oh, yeah,
you
I was
can't
called
be.
Jailbait.
I was called too old. You should know better.
But oh, that's awful.
In any case, it's hurtful for someone who's trans and has struggled with identity and gender issues to be told, you're not who you say you are. And how do we accept each other's truths? Philip, I'm going to throw this to you because I know it's a question you've thought about.
Well, it's also, you know, it gets back to the thing about in our own communities, that not only racism, but a lot of people deny that bisexuality exists at all.
Yeah.
And I just find that the best thing to do is to live by example. Call out even call out very subtle things that people may not know that they're doing and call out the really big things. But somewhere in the middle, there can be some humor in dealing with that. And humor not necessarily in making jokes, but humor as dealing with life is, mm-hmm. is how I actually think of humor.
And Michelle?
Well, part of it, I think, is just in general, we don't have civil discourse with each other anymore. You shut up yourself. We always seem to be on, we have this win or lose mentality.
And you come out of sports.
And I come out of sports, so I can say that. We have this win or lose mentality now. And the idea that if I can't get you to agree with me, then, you know, I've lost or I'm wrong. It's mm-hmm. right and wrong, win and lose, mm-hmm. instead of discussion and then coexist.
And well, I have to say, Bonnie, I want to have you speak to this. That was huge for me when I read about many new women coming out were not accepted. Because, you know, there was already this culture in place, and suddenly it clicked for me. This has been bothering me for 23 years. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it clicked that there were two sides to this equation. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I mean, what I'm trying to do as a historian is not force anyone to share my viewpoint or to shame any a different viewpoint, but to say, how did we get here? This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and what cultural moment are we in? What is the overlap? The overlap is you have, in my experience, a group that struggled to gain visibility, legal status, and to find its cultural past, to find out who were the lesbians in history, how many of us have been here all along, where do we come from, who were others like us, who were our role models, when there were no out role models in the mainstream. Okay, so that is not a completed revolution. That is still going on. And while that is going on, the movement shifted to LGBT with a kind of emphasis, everybody in it together, to have separate events is no longer acceptable. It's a marker of oppressiveness. And I think it's still important for some lesbians who are not trans to have events that speak to their experience in the same way it's important for people who identify as trans to have a support group. But that is one of the big misunderstandings about what the specific ethos of the Michigan Festival was. It's really important, and this is something that I often say to people in interviews. I give people who want to pick on Michigan a quiz. If you can name 15 other festivals that from the beginning admitted trans women and even guys, my dad went to Sister Fire, do your homework and don't say that all of festival culture is transphobic or be inaccurate. You know, Michigan did not check people at the gate or anything like that. That is a myth that has been perpetuated through the ease of social media, which has enabled accelerating inaccurate information much faster than people who are historians and eyewitness journalists like me can correct the trail of false info. But the other thing I think is important to say is that the experience of people who went through festival culture is, no matter who you were, there were things you could not do or attend within festivals. You know, I don't go to the deaf women-only workshop. I don't go into the Women of Color's tent. That doesn't mean I'm not an ally or not part of the whole larger group. It means that there are affinity groups for those identities. And, you know, Michigan was a giant affinity group, you know, for women assigned female at birth or whatever. Now, in the experience you had of people saying, if you're not like this, you don't get to be gay, or if you're not like this, I don't see you as, I understand exactly what you're saying. What happens when then we have lesbians saying to trans women, I don't see you as? So that's the conversation that's going on right now. The problem, and you're joking about lack of civil discourse is great, is the change in culture has occurred at the same moment as a change in technology. And the technology change, where we're all on Facebook and social media, not only allows mean things to be said at the push of a button and disseminated to billions, but it's the anonymous posting allow people to issue death threats daily without being accountable. And it's very different than the Pilgrim Town Hall where, you know, if you stood up and said, "Sister Eileen, I accuse thee of being a witch," you could see your accuser and engage them in a discussion. And they had to be called on their bringing that charge. Not like that now. Now you have people who can casually say, "I deplatform you," and ruin your life economically and make it impossible for you to perform at the next event with the creation of one entry that says, "Hey, let's boycott any person who ever appeared at the Michigan Festival ever." And so that's going to include, let's silence, erase, and shut down, you know, Alice Walker and Dorothy Allison and Stacey Ann Chin. And I think people who want to go in that direction don't really know the intersectional variety of the artists they're talking about, that looks like.
I think when you said don't know, that's the key. One thing I've noticed on Facebook, and Philip, I'm going to ask you, is people pour in from other countries, from other states, other cities. They don't even know what they're talking about. They just know that a button has been pushed and they are going to respond. And they don't even know what they're talking about. Philip, are you finding this on Facebook?
Oh, well, yes. And as we've also learned, there are also paid trolls who are the first to respond, usually.
Wow.
To things. And there are people who are... There was an article that I posted today that I was just checking the comments on and responding to. List of voters and interviews with voters who voted a particular way. I'm not going to say which way, but they're now finding that the programs that they depend on are being cut. And mm-hmm. It will mean loss of jobs for many of them and loss of any kind of support for them. But they still say they would vote the same way in the next election for that particular 45 office, or the Dolt 45 office, as I've grown to call it. And so they, wait, what were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about...
Oh, about people on Facebook.
Yeah.
And that is exactly how it is. They have the knee-jerk reaction of... If it comes from this particular source, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. If it comes from that particular source, I'm going to support it.
I think one of the answers you and I have talked about, and Michelle, you said that that's one of the things you appreciated about the Disappearing L, is we need to tell our stories because that helps us make connections. Bonnie, one thing you did very effectively in this book is tell your story. Going to festivals, sitting there with your notebook, being in the tent, you know, as you talk to people about Shabbat, it mm-hmm. was so effective that it wasn't just statistics. Michelle, you talked about this.
Well, and also the thing that really struck me, Bonnie, was that right from the beginning, you felt it was important to get other people's experiences too. And not just to tell, your experience. And so really to build a history, you know, of the festival in a more expansive way than just a single person's thoughts about it.
Yes, and to the listening audience, what we're referring to here is that beginning the summer of 86, so for a good 30 years, I would pass around a blank book at every festival I went to and just ask women to write, what does this mean to you? What brought you back if this is your second or tenth time? What's your favorite memory? What would you like to write down about why this culture is precious to you? And then I would just, with complete faith, launch this blank book into an audience of, 6,000 and just say, "Return it to my blanket at the end of the evening." I have these about, I guess, five big filled little bound journals with every kind of reaction, and there's artwork, and some women wrote their phone numbers, and what they wrote about was a sense of safety, seeing their children blossom, over and over the theme, my batteries are recharged for the coming year. They marvel at the variety of bodies. Many talk about losing shame at understanding for the first time they're beautiful. And what a contrast it is to being, you know, fat shamed elsewhere or not being able to be open with having lost a breast or whatever it might be. And then the other theme would be being able to identify with one particular performer who might have raised thematic material that you just don't hear on mainstream airplay. And it could be something very serious like incest or recovery, but it could also be just the naming of, let's say, two women in their 80s celebrating a long-term relationship. Or, you know, I think the sexuality of older women is an important theme that as I got older, I really appreciated. I mean, I was able to experience with thousands of women what it was like to be, you know, an out lesbian in my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And I think something that we risk in disappearing recent lesbian culture is that as these women who created it are now aging, what are we going to do with their legacy of stories? And my view is everyone ought to be rushing out with a tape recorder to interview every woman right now while they're here and alive. And as women are passing from us, we lose their untold stories. And I was very moved by this thesis written by a wonderful septuagenarian in England, Jane Treyas, and she talked about in England interviewing women who, once they were assigned to assisted living homes, were afraid to have their ex-partner's photo by their bedside because they worried about being treated abusively by caregivers who were anti-gay for religious reasons or whatever.
Bonnie, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there because we only have about one more minute.
Okay, well, anyway,
show.
I just want to tell everybody, don't make it so that an older lesbian is afraid to tell you about her time in lesbian festival culture.
And you have actually written a novel that you are reading from this weekend. Is that correct?
Yes, I have fiction coming out in June. It's called Sappho's Bar and Grill, and it's about a time travel in a haunted lesbian bar.
I also want to let people know how to contact you.
Sure. I have a website, www.bonniejmorris.com, and you can look me up.